And I'd like now to welcome Lauren Camp. She's a poet, an artist. She's a DJ on KSFR. Her program on Sundays at 5 in the afternoon is called Audio Saucepan. And she will be reading this Sunday, the 15th of April, from 3 to 4 in the afternoon at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation on West Barcelona here in Santa Fe. The reading is called The Need to Return, Four Writers on Family and Heritage. It's Lauren Camp and also Margaret Randall, Elaine Maria Upton, and Richard Vargas. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Wonderful to be here, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you. Now, this question about heritage is just endlessly fascinating because I think we as Americans are continually in danger of losing our heritage or feeling like we're losing our heritage. And we try to understand who we are through heritage. And I was wondering what your process was like in this respect.
Well, and also for virtually every one of us, our heritage is not here in the United States. It goes back to some other place or many other places. So my heritage on my father's side, which is what I'm going to be dealing with on the for the reading on Sunday, is Iraqi. When I was a child, and I'm familiar with it, I know it to some extent. I grew up with it around me. And when I...
Was he born there?
He was born in Baghdad and left for the United States in 1950. He was 15.
Ah.
And I knew all of that. And that's about where it ended. That's about where my knowledge ended, where he said, and this was the date we came to the United States. And because there was never a reason to ask why, because it was somehow, he didn't say, don't ask me any questions, but it was somehow just not the thing we did, I never thought to wonder, why would somebody leave their homeland? I mean, I was a little girl. That just didn't occur to me. Why would you leave a country, come around the world, and start again? Until just a few years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
So when you were in your teens or early 20s, it never occurred to you to ask
never.
Him.
So I feel like there must have been some kind of like invisible wall that said, don't ask about that. But I don't know.
Now, did you end up actually interviewing him or talking to him?
Not really. So I've created a manuscript that is still in progress, but that is about his childhood in Baghdad. My dad's alive and well. He's happy, he's healthy, and he doesn't say anything about it.
Real? Does he know you're doing this?
Sort of. That's a really complicated area to go into, but I thought he just didn't want to answer the questions, and then it turned out that just last year when I was probing gently, like, who was your English teacher, or when did you go, how did you get to school, or anything, I found that there were lots of things he didn't remember. And I think that's now where that wall has moved to. If there was a time that he knew the answers, he no longer does.
So what kinds of questions were you and are you interested in knowing?
So the real crux of it, what really got me started, is something called the Farhud, which was a two-day event that happened in Baghdad in June 1941. And it was effectively a raping, looting, pillaging, killing of the Jewish population. My dad would have been six.
And Jewish.
And from a Jewish family. Jewish on both sides. And the Jews in Iraq were a large population at that point. So I didn't know anything about this. And yet my dad had been sending me articles by email for years. These long, like pages and pages of articles about the Farhud. And that's what it would say. And I would sort of look at them and look at the length and say, I'll read this later. And never any message about it. One day I sat down and started looking at it. And I had so many of these articles. And that's when I put it together. He was six. His childhood probably wasn't happy. It was
not
sort of
that day.
Not that day and not before that either. So I started looking into the whole history of the country based like in that time period that he would have been a child, a young man, a teenager. what it must have been like. And that was really what started me. I have gotten tiny bits of information from my father. He told me what street they lived on, the number and the name of the street, Batawin Street. And I was fascinated by that. That became something real that I could grab onto. And I went to the internet, found maps of Baghdad from that time period, 1940s, and looked it up. And there it was, Batawin Street. And I could say, oh, okay, here's where he was in relation to the river. Here's where he was in relation to this and that. Of course, the city is now completely different. But so the tiny things he was able to give me, I was able to then go further and research and put together my own sense of what might have been going on, what his childhood might have been like.
I mean, if he was sending you these emails, it sounds like he wanted you to ask.
I think so. But then when I asked, he didn't answer. And he didn't answer anything. You know, I would ask and he would sort of push my emails or my questions off to his cousins or just ignore them.
Like, Dad, why did you leave Iraq and come to the United States?
And nothing. He would, no, nothing. So it became sort of this weird game, and at some point it became, okay, you know, I'm bothering him. Like, he's actually unhappy with me for asking. And last year I realized, oh, he's unhappy because he doesn't remember, because I'm pushing against something that doesn't exist there anymore. So
you were doing something which you can't really call memoir, biography, or documentary, because you don't actually have any solid information. It's like a work of, or very little. So it's a work of imagination.
It's sort of a combination of everything, and then add to it that it's all written in poetry.
Right.
So it's part memoir, it's part, so I'm interviewing cousins, I'm talking to and reading books, I'm looking at maps, I'm looking at photos, I'm looking at timelines, genealogy stuff that our larger family has posted. But yeah, it's part fiction, it's part imagined. It's not fiction, really, it's imagined, which I think is different.
Would you like to read one of your poems?
Sure.
We're talking to Lauren Camp.
Letter to Baghdad. Even if my father never speaks a word of it, I will know he brought a candle, a cough, and the occupied side of his heart. I will know the trees held him, that they rose above roof lines, and where they met he climbed and saw roads paved only with praises. The sun he carried across oceans turned copper at his window. I saw it too, on the gray edge of my childhood, and I was marked when each day awoke. He devoured the silence, the parts that could not be cured, and when he was hungry for it, I swallowed the silence, his self-portrait of confession. When I found an old shawl and silver teapot in the oven and he pretended he didn't know what they meant, I remembered bitter lemons had moistened his mouth. What he inhaled from his copious memory left his tongue empty, then full, and somehow I know his tongue will always be brushed with the leaving. One day, we were talking about beginnings, and I had begun. I wasn't at the center anymore, but we kept letting in a little air, and he showed me a word for the boy he once was, and he showed me this Arabic word, and in this way I knew this was the most authentic morning I would ever see. And I saw it, and he said it again, and we were covered with it, entirely covered. This was his home, he said, as he gave me the address, the place where the first time and the spurned and the color and the milkmaid stood in the alley. And even though he didn't tell me about yesterday and the day, and I never saw any other way to tell it, I never saw heaven or the land that was black. One day I knew enough to take the word from him and drink my fill of everything, every little thing, every steeped thing. And there were many trees and not enough cold. And we sat by the river that curves in every direction and our hearts lifted up to the birds.
Lauren Camp reading from a collection of poems, and you'll be reading this and many others.
From this collection.
From this collection. Yeah. On
Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation.
So the question of knowing the details about one's parents, about one's ancestors, which so many of us ask, particularly those of us, I think, who have immigrant parents and immigrant grandparents, how does it fill you, how does it complete you in a way that wasn't there before you embarked on this kind of work?
The question of knowing your parent is actually really intriguing, because I don't know more about my dad from doing all this research. A couple of years of research now. I don't actually know more directly from him, and I think the fact that I, at first that's frustrating. What, you know, he could just give me the information and then I could have it and I could write it in my poetic, whatever, tone and style and line. But he didn't do that. And that forced me to collect bits and pieces and to imagine his story. Firstborn male in a Jewish family. One of my dad's cousins told me he was the prince of that family because he was that firstborn male. And that led me off in a new direction. So I feel like I'm not sure this answers your question exactly, but I feel like I'm given these tiny little gems, and they sort of glow from places, and I take them and I run with them, and I make them into something larger. And in a way that gives me a lot more appreciation for my dad, who is very tight-lipped about it.
So here we have a relationship between our country and Iraq, which has not been very pretty over the last few years. I mean, invasion and occupation of a country for bogus reasons we know in retrospect, and we really knew then if mm-hmm. we had our eyes open. How does that affect your relationship to the whole subject of your own heritage, if it does?
Well, it doesn't affect my dad's relationship at all. He's pretty much stayed out of the whole current events scene.
That's amazing.
Amazing. And more complicated on a different level. But it affects me in that, as a child, I would say, my dad's from Iraq. You know, when teachers would say, you know, we're doing heritage today.
And, right.
You know, you need to know where your mother's from, where your father's from. My dad's from Iraq, or we're celebrating this thing, or this food that I brought in is, you know, this is tamarind, and nobody knew what it was. And I would be so proud of that, and nobody knew what Iraq was or where it was. And now, of course, that's totally different. Now it's in the news all the time. And so in a way, I feel like I lost this special little secret thing that I owned, which was this connection to this country.
Do you feel that, how should I say this, parts of Iraqi culture have filtered into your life in various ways?
The language, even though I don't speak it, I don't understand it, the sound of the language is a part of my body.
Did you somehow. You heard it?
I heard
up.
It. I yeah. heard it. Yeah. We would spend time. My grandparents came. My father's whole family, his siblings and his parents came, right around the same time. My dad came a few weeks later, and we would spend pretty much once every 3 weeks with my grandparents. So that I heard the language all around me, the prayers, the food. So all of that is definitely in me somehow.
You are an artist. You work in so many different forms. You do the DJing at KSFR, if you can call that an art form, but you work as a fiber artist, so you're a visual artist. You work in poetry, which is a literary and almost musical form.
Right.
How do you bring these things together? Is the visual art part of this particular heritage project?
Not at all. Actually, I'm thinking, I don't think I've done anything. What I've done in fabric more is jazz related, is
yeah.
music related, and self portraits and images of women. But no, they're in a way, for a long time it was like the three things, and I do consider radio an art form. The three things were entirely separate. They were like each their own circles, and they were far from each other. And then they started blending. Like there would be overlaps between certain things. But no, the visual art, I never did try to bring the Iraqi heritage in at all.
Interesting.
I never really thought about it before. Yeah, it's more like something comes to me, something that I want to do, and the medium comes at the same time. Like, oh, okay, a poem would be the easiest way to say this. Not that it would be easy, but it would... it would be the way that
the
I could,
right way.
Right, the right way that I could ultimately challenge myself to say it. And visual art never felt like the right fit for that.
Interesting. We're talking to poet and artist Lauren Camp. So you'll be reading from this set of poems on Sunday. The event is called The Need to Return, Four Writers on Family and Heritage. How did you four come together?
The Unitarian Church asked me to do an event as part of their Drama on Barcelona series. And I decided I wanted to do something on family and heritage because that was where I was thinking. That was where my energies were going. And I immediately started thinking about who else I could involve in the event. Ultimately, I invited three other writers who all said yes. They're phenomenal writers. All of them are poets. Two of them are reading stories, though. Richard Vargas is reading a story about his childhood, sort of a creative nonfiction memoir piece about his childhood in Compton, California. Margaret Randall, who was raised partly in New York and partly in Albuquerque, is reading stories about, I think, about both places and also about some of her relatives and imagined realities. And Elaine Upton is reading about her literary ancestors. She's sort of taken the characters from The Heart is a Lonely Hunter and continued that story after the novel ends.
And so all four of you will be reading on Sunday. What a great event.
It's going to be fantastic. I've been excited to hear them. I actually requested the two stories. I had either heard or read them, and I begged those writers to come and read. So
what, they needed begging?
No. Well, I mean, they both said yes, but I was just like, please read this specific thing.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Now, you, along with everything else you do, and you're a very busy gal, are teaching, you're doing various kinds of teaching, including helping people to write their own memoirs.
That's right.
That's a very interesting process.
It's fabulous. I mean, it's because the people who are writing memoirs and stuck don't have the confidence to continue. And I'm able to help them sort of chunk it down, break it down to small stories, anecdotes, and begin to tell that story and begin to assemble it with the help of effectively a coach or a buddy who can, you know, who can pick out things and say, go further. This is interesting. Go, you know, and deal with the grammar and deal with the storyline.
The grammar.
Very
important.
Yeah.
Now, I think memoir is such an interesting form because it's become very, very popular.
Everybody wants to tell their story.
Everyone wants to tell their story, but I don't know about you. I don't want to read everybody's story. And so the question of, I mean, I think there are memoirs that should be written for the sake of the family.
That's
and
right.
That the children and grandchildren can read them. And there are memoirs that should be written for the sake of all mankind.
Well, it's interesting because I was thinking about this, how a memoir that, how a life story that is basically peaceful and happy doesn't really have a humongous audience. People want to read about abuse and difficult situations, and maybe those are the memoirs that really make it to the top 10 best-selling books. But I do think everybody has a story that is valid. Everybody has a life that is valid, and so everybody should be allowed to tell that story, and maybe you're right. Maybe it doesn't go further than family.
Well, there's abuse and there's difficulty, but there's also then people who've actually done something. I mean, I had the great privilege of interviewing Robert J. Lifton last year. He wrote a memoir about his whole life, and his whole life was connected with the life of some of the great events on this planet,
right,
starting with the dropping of the atomic bomb in Hiroshima.
Right. So yes, then there's the, you know, how does history fit around you? How do you fit into history? And it's been just exciting work to work with writers, all sorts of writers, emerging writers just doing creative writing, and then these other writers who are working on memoirs.
Now, you also do this show on Audio Sauce, called Audio Saucepan on KSFR, and I know people miss you because you used to do The Colors of Jazz from 9 to 12 on Monday mornings and became a fixture on KSFR for years and years, and now you're doing this Sunday afternoon show, which is more than jazz.
It's way more than jazz. It's world music. It's everything. And it's poetry. And it's not my poetry, which is Which is sort of great to be able to pick several poems for the week and use my voice to share them with listeners. You know, use that medium of radio to mix the music and the poems, the words, and really get a sort of composite of sounds. But yeah, the music is all over the globe. It's whatever I'm interested in that week.
Do you sort of go all over the place, or do you choose things that fit together, or how does that work?
They fit together for me. I guess it's sort of the same. This is where those circles overlap, where the fiber art overlaps. I always thought certain colors went together just because they felt good inside me. I would put them together and I would get this certain feeling. And so music is sort of the same for me. It's like the music has colors and they, or beats or whatever, and they work together. And I could go, if those segues are right, I could go from one genre into something completely different. And ideally, the listener will go along with me.
Lauren Camp, would you like to read another poem?
Sure, I'd be glad to. I'm going to read a poem from my book. The poem's called My First Year. And so in a way, it's family and heritage again. It goes back to my parents when I was young. My First Year. In 1967, my mother is already my mother in the seedy, boiled metal of Manhattan, below the women's fancy clothing at Macy's Herald Square, where she works and buys her clothes. In 1967, my mother has stopped her cigarettes. The U.S. blasts through operations Latchkey and Crosstie with tests named Bourbon, Persimmon, Fizz, Cerise, and Polka, apt descriptions of my mother's vibrant outfits. And my little wrinkled body stretches out. My father bathes my hot pink flesh in a plastic tub. John and Paul sing Penny Lane. We wander to the park at 4th and Waverly, my mother in coral bell bottoms and a yellow blouse. Returning home, she sips rosé, satisfied. In 1967, NBC argues the Vietnam War, a frenzy of race riots. My parents too busy to listen. What they don't hear keeps climbing away. My father watches the first Super Bowl as a married man. Peggy Fleming skates in a formal ice rink dressed in pink, my mother's eyes entranced. My mother buys a charming pea coat for her 5'10 frame. Sex oozes onto streets and down alleys. Neil Armstrong practices landing on the moon. In 1967, everyone drops acid while my father goes to work. From the couch, my parents watch Milton Berle. My mother lands in the city of humor and stays there smiling as the show keeps ending. In 1967, my mother drags my cradle to the TV set. Fred Rogers walks us through the neighborhood and my mother grits her teeth. Fred teaches make-believe while my mother organizes her pretty clothing. What is happening isn't happening in my house.
Lauren Camp, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
And we'll see you on Sunday at 3:00 at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation.